The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
The worst story of 2020 and the worst national security story of 2020 is hands down, without any close competition, the complete and utter failure of the coronavirus response by the U.S. federal government.
Even if the Democrats win the two Georgia Senate races, they're going to still have trouble pushing any sort of ambitious agenda through.
Has Donald Trump shown us that the arrangements that we've relied upon, that we came into this year and the last several years with, are they strong enough to propel us into this next decade and this next phase of American history?
We are once again hearing indications that a major confrontation with Iran might be part of the last few days of a Trump administration.
Well, I have to say, my first pick for a villain was Bill Barr, and then my second pick for a villain was Mitch McConnell.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 30th, 2020. It is the last podcast of the year 2020, no less. So we thought we would give 2020 an appropriate send-off. Good riddance, bad rubbish. We're going to talk about the worst stories of the year, as well as our expectations and predictions for the coming year. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio, Lawfare executive editor Susan Hennessy, managing editor Quinta Jurassic, senior editor Scott Anderson, and from the wild and woolly north of Minnesota, Professor Alan Rosenstein. We're going to give 2020 the send-off it deserves. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 30th. Bye-bye, 2020. Susan, I want to start with you. It's been a year of truly terrible stuff. What is the lowest moment of 2020 from your point of view?
I don't know that I can pinpoint a precise low moment. That said, I think the worst story of 2020 and the worst national security story of 2020 is hands down, without any close competition, the complete and utter failure of the coronavirus response by the U.S. federal government. And this is an especially significant failure, everything from controlling the initial spread, rolling out testing, you know, now vaccine distribution, just every part of this has been sort of an unmitigated disaster. And this entire system, the benefit of the American system is supposed to be that it is very, very well designed to operate in precisely these kinds of emergencies, sort of the ability to rapidly respond, you know, strong muscular executive power, lots and lots of flexible emergency authorities, right? It's all designed to sort of rise to this particular challenge. And so, you know, this has been an ongoing illustration of the idea that the American presidency and the American executive does not run on autopilot. And if you don't have a competent president, everything falls apart. And there is precisely one part of our system and one part of this design that functioned as it was supposed to. And that's that whenever you have a really, really incompetent and dangerous president, we have a system that can vote that person out of office. And so, you know, we'll see sort of the restoration project that begins on January 20th of next year at the conclusion of Donald Trump's term. So I don't know that that I can pinpoint the precise moment that sort of encapsulates all of that. But I just make no contest that's the most significant bad news national security story of this year.
All right. So Susan has thrown down the gauntlet. She challenges all of the rest of you to name a story that competes with this one for bad news story of the year. Anybody want to pick up the gauntlet with any other story of the year?
So I'm happy to pick up the gauntlet. So I think Susan's absolutely right that the coronavirus is among the worst stories, but I think there's actually a worse story, and that is the refusal of President Trump and of most of the Republican Party establishment to quickly and appropriately concede the results of the 2020 election.
Whoa, hot take here, Alan. You're saying that a few tweets is up there with, you know, 300,000 American deaths and lots more around the world?
So here's the
notice
argument.
Notice how I stacked the deck. In
thanks for that, Ben. No, here's the argument. So obviously Susan is right in that in terms of pure lives lost, there's nothing remotely comparable to the coronavirus. But what strikes me as really notable is that although the United States did underperform relative to expectations, and although the United States did underperform relative to other similar countries, let's say in Europe, like Germany, in many ways, what is surprising is that despite the total failure of the federal government, and in particular of the White House, to manage the coronavirus epidemic properly, the ultimate, you know, whether it's death rate or infection rate or, you know, whatever metric you want, is still comparable to other large developed countries, especially if you look at Europe, for example. Now, of course, that doesn't mean, or that's not to excuse the failures of the Trump administration. And there's no question that Trump's failures have cost, you know, thousands, if not tens of thousands of lives. But what does strike me as really notable is that lots of countries, including those that are, you know, that seem to be much better run in this moment, have suffered some pretty catastrophic outcomes from coronavirus. And then I compare that to the 2020 election. And here, I think the United States stands alone in its complete electoral dysfunction, at least among Western democracies. And so this is why, to me, the performance of the United States with respect to the election is more disturbing than the performance with respect to coronavirus. Obviously, the effects of coronavirus are much more tragic than, as you put it, some tweets and some frivolous lawsuits. But when I compare America to other Western democracies, what really makes me afraid is not its ability to deal with disasters, but its ability to preserve its democracy.
All right, Quinta and Scott, Susan has thrown down the gauntlet. Alan has picked it up. We have a dispute. Quinta first, then Scott. Who's right here? Or do you want to put another horrible news story on the table as the top horrible news story in the national security space of 2020?
I mean, the obvious answer here, not to sort of put a lampshade on the whole question, is that everything sucked. And there's no way of categorizing what constitutes the most horrible without, you know, a more concrete metric. But I would say, look, I think it is important to recognize that what both Susan and Alan have identified obviously come from the same place, which is Donald Trump as the proximate cause and an enormous amount of rot underneath that as the cause that sort of goes back farther, historically speaking. I think that one of the things that you see having, you know, focused on Trump for 4 years is that everything he does is kind of a fractal of itself. And as you go down and down, just everything, every action that he takes contains within it all of the other terrible actions he takes. And you can sort of see reflected in each other how each thing leads to each other terrible thing. And so, you know, the sort of disregard for human life and greed and self-importance that we see in the mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic is also something that we see in the handling of the post-election madness. So it's turtles all the way down.
Wow. So we have thesis from Susan, antithesis from Rosenstein, and then we have Quinta attempting to create the unified field theory here of it's all the same story because Trump. Scott, what do you think?
So I think to some extent Quinta's right. But at one point, I think it's only getting at one of the causes here, because it is not just about Donald Trump and the things that he chooses to do and the decisions he's made as president, but the way that it interacts with the institutions of government as we've inherited them in ways that are kind of unprecedented. The COVID-19 pandemic is an unprecedented challenge, largely unprecedented, but not one entirely unforeseen. A lot of decisions were made in regards to how to approach it, but they're also made in this particular context about how we've chosen to allocate authorities and the ability to prepare for a crisis like this. And put major challenge on our kind of federalist system, among other major challenges, about saying, well, to what extent is this a crisis the federal government should? What do you do if federal government doesn't act enough in this particular area, perhaps, to take the threat seriously enough? How do other states respond? With the election, this is the sort of situation, while it hasn't arisen often in the past, it's always been sort of theorized. It's always been a possibility. We just never had a president quite ready to take it to the mat like Trump has approached, or at least seems like he might be preparing to do in the next few days, and has suggested it's taken these sorts of steps. But the reason he's able to do that is because we have institutional arrangements in place that allow the president to do that, in part because we've always had enough confidence that we either are electing people with enough baseline character that that's not going to happen, or baseline judgment, or because the political incentives are just not there for them to ever undertake that sort of action. And the thing I would take away from this is not that Donald Trump is necessarily the big takeaway from 2020, that he's the source of the ills here. I think it's really the question we have to walk away from 2020 is has Donald Trump shown us that the arrangements that we've relied upon, that we came into this year and the last several years with, are they strong enough to propel us into this next decade and this next phase of American history?
All right. So let's talk about the national security stories that we should have talked more about this year, but didn't, because Trump and COVID and the election sucked all the air out of the room. Scott, I want to start with you on this. It seems to me that the big one at this time, shortly after this time last year, we all thought we were on the point of a major confrontation with Iran over the killing of Qasem Soleimani. As we go out of 2020, we are once again hearing, you know, indications that a major confrontation with Iran might be part of the last few days of a Trump administration. Is Iran one of the big under-discussed stories of the year?
I think it absolutely is, but not just Iran, but again, what Iran really symbolizes about the way that we have come to approach certain major national security decisions and what the Trump presidency has meant for that sort of arrangement. I remember last year on New Year's Eve, I was working up until fairly late in the evening, much to the chagrin of my wife, working on an article about what at the time seemed like a major crisis, which was the fact that protesters had broken into the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, in part as a response to another set of U.S. airstrikes at the very end of the year, which is itself in response to a rocket attack by Iranian-backed militias in Iraq that killed a U.S. contractor. And that all did sort of fall away a few days later to the Soleimani strike and sort of aftermath. And we saw a lot of debate about what exactly that strike meant. You know, some people lauded it, like General Petraeus famously said that maybe this is a step towards reestablishing effective deterrence with Iran. I was fairly skeptical of it. Many other people were, as to saying this seems like a very provocative and risky step to take in a situation where we're on the cusp of crisis. And we saw it play out in a way that doesn't quite rise to the level of the complete disaster that some people foretold, but also I don't think really reveals it to be a particularly you know, happy story. We saw a major act of retribution by Iran. The Trump administration nonetheless chose to say, in part because there were no US fatalities resulting from that Iranian action, to say, okay, we're going to not pursue an initial immediate tit a tat. But instead, over the course of the year, you saw this constant tension where we see the American diplomatic presence under immense pressure, immense scrutiny in Iraq, US military presence there increasingly unwelcome by Iraqi authorities. What was once a keystone in America's regional strategy across two administrations, this idea of establishing and maintaining some stability in Iraq after the removal of the Hussein regime, has really been compromised pretty severely in pursuit of this maximum pressure campaign against Iran, broader hostilities against Iran. And that decision was brought about because of the preferences of the president and some of his chief advisors. And on top of that, I think it's worth noting, you know, the Soleimani strike is legally really questionable. I think domestic authorities wise, because of the way the 2002 AUMF in particular has been used in the past, I have said, other people disagree with me, but, you know, I have said I wasn't terribly surprised to see them rely on a domestic basis, even though I don't necessarily agree with that. That's the way that one should read the statute. It's not terribly surprising compared to past executive branch practice. But from an international law perspective, we still haven't gotten a very good explanation about why what the United States did was appropriate or lawful. The Trump administration chose not to release the War Powers Report it provided to Congress that initially provided the, at least what we hope would be a more lengthy justification for its action. Instead, it's really only released pretty summary, overlapping, confusing, fairly unclear explanations. And now, almost a year later, I don't think we know much more about it than we did in the few hours after the strike. A lot of the initial narratives justifying it, saying that he was involved with this imminent attack on diplomatic presence or military presence there, really hasn't revealed itself. So it's a situation also where we've seen that the president was able to take a highly provocative action that certainly put the United States on a cusp of war, or certainly seemed to have that possibility, unilaterally in a matter that was seen as questionably legal, certainly internationally, domestically, and hasn't been held accountable for it by anyone, despite opposition within his own party, despite a majority of Congress voting to support a resolution that opposed these sorts of actions, but not the two-thirds necessary to override a presidential veto in the case of the War Powers resolution that ultimately followed the debate in Congress a few months after the Soleimani strike. So again, I think it's illustrative of a major story revealing a major issue or major deficiency, perhaps, or at least quirk in how our institutional arrangements around this major area of national security decision-making have kind of fallen short. But we stopped talking about it really in February or March. It hasn't gotten nearly the attention it deserves, in part because of initially the COVID crisis and then subsequently the election.
All right. So for those who are wondering, Scott's particular portion of the Virtual Jungle Studio has construction going on, and that explains some of the background noise in that regard. Alan, what is your big under-discussed story of the year that was squeezed out because of COVID and the election?
So to me, the big under-discussed story is China's continuing geopolitical rise and the failure of the West, and I guess in particular the United States, to effectively check that, given the opportunity that COVID, in fact, provided for that. So, you know, I think it's obvious that this century will continue to be, and it will increasingly be, the Chinese century or a Chinese century or a century in which China returns to superpower status. And that's both inevitable and appropriate. It's the largest country in the world. It's an incredible, you know, many thousands-year-old civilization. There's no question that, you know, it's important to bring China or to continue to support China's rise, you know, commensurate with its power and its fundamentals. But under Xi Jinping, China has moved in an increasingly authoritarian direction, and one that really, I think, threatens its neighbors, and is a direction that America, I think, and the rest of the Western world should push back against at least somewhat. And COVID, I think, really provided this opportunity to show some of the flaws in the Chinese system. The fact that it originated in China is not by itself an indictment of the Chinese system, but the cover-up that initially occurred certainly is. And I think early in the COVID epidemic, you know, when it was still largely confined to China or when it was moving in its initial spread to countries like Italy, there was a lot of, I think, appropriate criticism of how China had handled it. And I think that was an opportunity to check the influence of China across the globe. Now, that was squandered, I think, in large part because the United States in particular handled COVID so embarrassingly poorly. And it lost the ability to show the rest of the world that, in fact, you can be a non-authoritarian country and still deal with emergencies. And so to me, it's kind of amazing that even if China's reputation, and there's some polling to bear this out, that even if China's reputation around the world will have suffered because of COVID, it will have suffered much, much less than it otherwise would have. And I think that it should have. And so this to me is a really lost opportunity to, I think, remind the world that the authoritarian turn that China has gone through, in particular under Xi Jinping, is not something to emulate. And the fact that we failed to counter that effectively, I think is going to be something that we're going to be dealing with over the next decade or two.
So are you saying, if I could put it in a briefer form, Alan, are you saying we had the opportunity to kick China hard when it was down and we passed it up?
It's not that we had the opportunity to kick China when it was down. We had the opportunity to show and to highlight why China, the Chinese, the authoritarian model that is China under Xi Jinping, is not one that is worth emulating by other countries, and that it is not one that, if you're a country that is trying to decide which geopolitical camp to align yourself with, is necessary to align yourself with, right? It's not about kicking China when it was down. It's about showing that the Chinese model has some serious flaws. And we weren't able to do that because it turns out that the Western model, and in particular the American model, had in a sense even worse flaws.
Susan, what's your big under-discussed story of the year that we missed because of COVID and the election?
Yeah, so I agree with Alan. I think that China really is the story that didn't get nearly enough attention, despite really sort of earth-shattering things happening over the course of the year. I mean, sort of even setting aside sort of Hong Kong entirely and kind of the failures of the United States to take any kind of leadership role there. Back in January, we had this massive indictment against Huawei. There was sort of the commingling of ordinary criminal indictments with trade negotiations that caused a lot of concern about whether or not the United States was feeding into perceptions of sort of hostage taking as part of its trade negotiations. We have national security leaders for the past 3 years basically pounding the table and saying, yes, Russia's a big deal, but it's China, it's China, it's China. And in particular, whenever we talk about cybersecurity and sort of the contest for shaping the norms and kind of the rules of the road moving forward, what exactly is our strategy and our approach vis-a-vis China? We've seen the Trump administration effectively withdraw from the Xi agreement. That sort of lapsed entirely. And then we haven't seen it replaced by anything other than sort of tough rhetoric and these sort of sporadic episodes around Huawei and TikTok and, sort of launching allegations related to the coronavirus. This is a really pressing national security concern. It's also a really difficult one. This is not an area in which anybody, including Joe Biden, can sort of come in and say, well, the Trump administration did everything wrong, and here's the really easy solution. This is a complicated area in which, at the end of the day, the United States has to be willing to engage in serious self-constraint, in areas in which it is not in our immediate interest to do so. And where even if we do reach the agreements to not engage in particular behavior in cyberspace in hopes of establishing international norms, and we have no guarantees that our adversaries will do the same or that it'll even work at the end of the day. So I think that's the, when we look back and sort of setting aside all of the stories we've already discussed thus far, this period in history and the lack of focus on China, the lack of serious thinking, the lack of a serious bipartisan sort of national security discussion about China, I think that's going to, it's going to age poorly and look worse and worse as the years go by, as this was a period in which we really, really took our eye off the ball in really very consequential ways.
Quinta, what's your nomination?
I'm going to once again be kind of a jerk and sort of play with the premise of the question a little bit. I would say...
Jerk.
I've spent a lot of time over the last year podcasting and writing and thinking about disinformation and misinformation. And I actually don't think that that is an undercovered story. I want to flip this on its head a bit and say I think it's actually an overcovered story. And what I mean by that is that it's very easy to say, you know, Trump is distracting from all of these other things that we've discussed. But I think that over the last year, it's become very striking to the extent to which I would say exaggerated concerns over disinformation have, or foreign disinformation, have really crowded out, I think, bigger conversations about what is happening right now in all kinds of forums and the direction that the country needs to go post-Trump. There are just so many instances where people point to something that seems like a disinformation problem and to some extent may be a disinformation problem, but if you just scratch a little bit and dig a little deeper, it becomes very clear that the problem is, you know, a much bigger sort of structural difficulty with, in many cases, American democracy, right? Like when people are arguing about, say, Trump posting election misinformation on Twitter, to some extent, that's a problem of how Twitter is handling lies. But to some extent, it's also a problem of the fact that the U.S. elected Trump in the first place. And I think that concerns over disinformation coming from abroad, while it's certainly not a non-issue, often can sort of prevent a reckoning in that way as well. So I guess my recommendation for 2021 is that everybody should just take a deep breath about disinformation.
All right, let's take a deep breath and talk about 2021. Susan, let's start with you this round. What's the big story you want everyone to focus on in 2021? If it has a dominant theme other than vaccination, what would that dominant theme be if Susan ran the world?
Yeah, so I'll do a Quinta-esque pushback in that, you know, in 2021, we need to, you know, have the ability to focus on a lot of things simultaneously. So I wouldn't necessarily argue as a dominant theme. I would say one area that I hope is not lost and that I hope gets significant attention is the project of depoliticizing not just the intelligence community and the Department of Justice, but national security decision-making generally, and returning to a period of time in which there was some understanding of sort of a national security process and space that wasn't unrelated to politics, but ultimately was grounded in competing understandings of what was in the national interest, as opposed to the sort of reality-free zone and an area in which some of the most controversial national security decisions of the past 4 years have been just whether or not we want to acknowledge reality or not. That's a really, really bad place to be in. This is an area in which the path forward is incredibly difficult. And the task for the members of Joe Biden's cabinet in this space really couldn't be harder, because their job is not just to restore the traditional processes that allowed for sort of the civil service to, you know, to conduct their work and to produce their analysis and discharge their mission free of political interference, but also finding a way to do so that restores institutional confidence, public confidence, that restores a functional relationship with Congress. And they have to do that at a time in which, by all indications, at least one political party in Congress has no interest in behaving functionally or doing that sort of restoration project, right? The days of, you know, a Rogers-Ruppersberger kind of reform of the HPSI is just fantastical whenever you think about sort of Devin Nunes being the ranking member. And that scenario plays out, you know, along dozens of different committees in the House and Senate. But at the end of the day, sort of restoring public faith, restoring institutional confidence depends on achieving buy-in from the other side, depends on finding validators to communities that are inherently suspicious. Remember that a lot of these processes in the first place were designed in order to create confidence and credibility in moments in which you needed communities to believe you who were inherently suspicious. And so just going back to those old processes is not going to be enough. We have to think about, all right, what are new approaches of producing intelligence information to the public, engaging in congressional oversight in a good faith and reasonable way, while also defending sort of executive prerogatives at the same time. This is an immensely complex endeavor. It's made even more difficult by sort of the hollowing out of baseline expertise. Certainly, we've sort of, there's been a precipitous drop over the past 4 years, but these are trends that existed for a long time. The inability of the federal government, the national security community, the intelligence community to attract and retain talent over the long term. And so, rebuilding the personnel, rebuilding historical memory, rebuilding fidelity to processes, rebuilding public trust and confidence. This all has to occur simultaneously. It all has to occur while there are lots of bad actors in this space attempting to make your jobs harder, both people who presumably are on your own team, other members of, within Congress and other actors within the United States, and certainly our adversaries are interested in stirring the pot as much as possible, and will capitalize on all the tools available to them, both in the disinformation space and also in testing our capacities, and limits in all kinds of different contexts. And so I think that's going to be one of the dominant or most significant national security challenges that we're going to face in 2021 and beyond. It's not going to be solved in the first year, but I do think that it's a place in which you have to get it right pretty quickly because the task at hand is just so monumental.
Scott, what's your big agenda item for 2021 and beyond?
Well, I think it fits in or comes a little bit off of Susan's about this move back towards, a more kind of effective process and approach to addressing some of these big policy questions hanging over us. But for me, the look, and it kind of spins off some of the same themes of my last two responses, it begins to drift back to Congress again, because I really do think we're actually entering a unique historical moment. The Trump administration has really shown there to be certain problems with the statutory regimes we have in a variety of policy areas, whether you think it's about the domestic use of federal law enforcement in the military, in U.S. cities in response to Black Lives Matters protests that happened this past summer, whether you think it's about things like the Soleimani strike and war powers, whether you think it's about national emergencies and the building of the border wall, whether it's about national emergencies again and the installation of tariffs in a variety of contexts or national security exceptions and the use of tariffs. All of these policy measures the Trump administration has pursued use statutory authorities in ways that seem resilient to judicial review, at least in, as we've seen it exercise so far, but have triggered real backlash in Congress and in both political parties, most notably. There were plenty of Republicans who were upset by a lot of these actions as well, although relatively few were willing to really take a strong stand against the administration. But it does set us up to this interesting moment where there seems like there is a bipartisan appetite for major reform in a lot of these areas of a type that I don't think we've really seen since the post-Watergate era. The problem is getting it on the agenda for Congress, seeing where it's going to find champions who are going to be willing to force the majority leaders in both chambers to make it part of the legislative agenda. Maybe that will come within the Biden administration. Certainly, there are plenty of people incoming with the Biden administration that have expressed concern and done deep thinking about this. But it's also possible the Biden administration is going to have a lot of other things on its agenda, including kind of more conventional Democratic policy agenda that may get priority over this in some respects. And to some extent, that'll depend on the control of Congress and how plausible those other aspects of its agenda are. But nonetheless, I really think of the next 2 years, certainly maybe the next 4 years, we should be looking to Congress to see how serious it is about pursuing some of these reforms. There have been a ton of pitches, a ton of interesting hard work by a lot of different corners, from the Article I Act, which is an effort to reform the National Emergencies Act that's sponsored by Senator Mike Lee, Republican, but also has bipartisan support, to a whole bundle of proposals being debated and talked about in the Rules Committee on the House side that are very, very interesting and worth a look at. But, you know, we have to wait and see whether we actually are going to see this effort to kind of reset in response to the Trump administration, or to keep those broader institutional parameters in place, kind of on the assumption that the Trump administration was kind of perhaps a one-off kind of dodge to the left in history, and that the future presidents are going to be more on the model of we've come to expect prior to the Trump administration, and therefore those institutional models still work for us. But that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking to Capitol Hill over the next 2 to 4 years.
Quinta, your big agenda item.
I don't think this is the most important thing by any respect, but it is something that I'm going to be watching very closely. I am going to be very interested to see how different political factions grapple with and remember or not what happened over the last 4 years. I think we're going to see a lot of effort on the side of certain Republicans to basically try to just kick everything that happened under Trump down the memory hole and pretend that this whole embarrassing little diversion never took place. And I think as a country, there's going to be a really crucial question of to what extent it is possible to hold on to that memory and that history, and write it into history without completely grinding the gears of government to a halt. We talk a lot about truth and reconciliation. I think there's been some interesting recent work in that field splitting the idea of truth from the idea of reconciliation. And so it will be interesting to me to see to what extent the Biden administration and members of Congress pick one over the other.
Alan, your big agenda item.
So I'm going to pick something that is pretty straightforward and we haven't talked about much at all for the last 4 years, and that's climate change. I mean, to me, climate change has always been, in the long run, at least, the only national security issue that really matters, just because so many of the things that we think of as driving conflict are going to be downstream from climate change over the next, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. You know, just to pick one kind of obvious example, there's so much conflict that is driven by migration, and climate change is going to increase the amount of migration by orders of magnitude as people flee places that are no longer, you know, hospitable for human life. And that's going to cause a lot of, you know, all sorts of destabilizing influences. And so, for obvious reasons, we haven't talked about climate change for the last 4 years because the Trump administration not only was uninterested in dealing with the problem, but was uninterested in acknowledging the existence of that problem. Hopefully, with a change to the Biden administration, the U.S. can re-engage in that process. It can rejoin the Paris Agreement. The Biden White House can, through executive orders and other unilateral presidential action, try to support the transformation of our economy towards one that is lower in carbon and is more based on renewables. Maybe, though, I'm skeptical about this, maybe there are some deals that can be worked out with Senate Republicans. Maybe Infrastructure Week can finally happen and some of that can be in a greener direction. But to me, even if not a lot gets done on climate change because of the political stalemate in Washington, but just a little bit gets done because we've moved from a Trump administration to a Biden administration, that will be an enormous achievement. The nature of climate change is such that the effects, both positive and negative, compound over many years. And so even a small push in, let's say, the positive direction in 2021 can have enormous dividends 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now. So I don't expect, again, climate change to be a huge part of the conversation next year, because even if the Democrats win the 2 Georgia Senate races, they're going to still have trouble pushing any sort of ambitious agenda through. But even if they can move towards a slightly better direction over the long run, that's going to have an enormous impact.
All right, let's do our mischief round before we go into New Year's toasts. I want from each of you your biggest national security hero of the year and your biggest national security villain of the year. I will go first just to get us started. I want to nominate Dr. Anthony Fauci for the biggest hero of the year. And for me, no one will replace Rick Grenell as the biggest, the person who turned the office of the DNI into a Twitter trolling operation strikes me as a very significant national security villain, albeit a somewhat comic villain. Scott, who are your nominees?
Sure. You know, it's a long range of options, but the two names, I guess, that jumped to mind immediately, and the first one, the hero one, is a little controversial, but I want to see what the historians say about this, is that it might be Mark Esper, which sounds like a strange choice, because there's a lot of things Mark Esper did, including this year, that I don't particularly like or agree with. But at the same time, he seemed to come out as a pretty forceful voice for restraint on a couple of different fronts, particularly in regards to the domestic use of the military and potentially in some other actions involving the military at various phases up to and around the election. And the way that he broke with the administration, and frankly, has been followed by this clear effort to impose loyalists in the Department of Defense, suggests to me that there may have been more, even more happening behind the scenes in terms of him acting within the scope of his constitutional duty, trying to do things opposing the Trump administration and President Trump, even when they may be doing things that he doesn't agree with, as a way a good cabinet official should. So I'm curious about that and put him forward perhaps as a figure that's going to be looked at on fondly in hindsight. In terms of the villain, I'm going to stick with soon to be departed, or I guess recently departed, Attorney General Bill Barr, who is in a similar situation, left before the end of the administration, also had some tension, maybe also exposed a little bit of restraint on President Trump, but then left with this incredible resignation letter that is so bootlicking, for lack of a better way to put it, and that really frames this whole narrative that, I don't know, it really makes me question how much of his departure was actually about any serious disagreement, or at least any willingness to stand up to the administration, so much as a way to perhaps just keep one's own hands a little bit clean without putting up that sort of resistance. So I think the historians will have to pass judgment on both of those, but those are two stories, at least I'm watching to see how they come out in hindsight in 2020.
Susan, your heroes and villains.
Yeah, so this seems like a long time ago, but back in January 2020, the President of the United States was impeached. And the reason that happened and the reason that the American people learned the story of what the president attempted to do in essentially extorting a foreign government into digging up dirt on his political opponent by holding hostage congressionally appropriated funds is because there were a number of people in the federal government who put their sort of duty to the country before their personal or professional well-being. And I think that group of people, still qualify as sort of the national security heroes of the year. There's lots of them. There's people like our colleague Fiona Hill, our newer colleague Alex Vindman, Marie Ivanovich, Bill Taylor, right? There's a long list of names who did the simple but extraordinary act of standing up and telling the truth under their own names and doing that on behalf of the nation, and I think performed a real service to their country. And while the year has sort of become subsumed with the coronavirus and these spiraling crises, that was important. It really mattered whenever we think about the overall health of our democracy in the long term. I think that's going to prove to be a really, really pivotal thing. And it wasn't inevitable, and it really depended on acts of courage and from people who had no idea how it was going to work out for them. So I think that those are my sort of heroes of the year. The obvious villain of all of this is Donald Trump, but I think that's too obvious. So instead, I will go ahead and nominate Mitch McConnell. We have had a lot of focus and conversation about the dysfunction stemming from the executive branch. But whenever we look at the diseased ecosystem in which we are currently operating, it is not a function purely of the president. It is not a function purely of the executive. It is also a function of a deeply sort of dysfunctional legislative process and Congress that simply does not have its priorities straight. And Mitch McConnell is really single-handedly to blame for a lot of this. And I think with the benefit of distance, history is going to judge him extraordinarily harshly for the harms he wrought against this country, for his complicity in the crimes and destruction of Donald Trump. And really, I just can't think of enough bad things to say about him. And so I will end it there. And, wonder if one thing that 2021 might bring, like a breath of fresh air sweeping the nation, might be a new Senate majority leader.
Quinta, your nominations for heroes and villains of 2020.
Well, I have to say my first pick for a villain was Bill Barr, and then my second pick for a villain was Mitch McConnell. So let the record show that we're all in agreement. As my third runner-up, I will take Mike Pompeo, who I will not miss, and I think has been a real sort of smirking, smug force for ill in the world, up to and including most recently, but not most gallingly, his insistence at calling out what he sees as illegitimate and anti-democratic actions around the world by every government except for his own, because of course he hasn't said anything about Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the election. When it comes to heroes, I am going to take Susan's approach and pick a whole swath of people. In this case, everyone who put their feet down and did not allow Trump to get away with his haphazard attempt to steal the election. That ranges from judges who were appointed by Trump or who have strong connections to a conservative movement that has sort of been taken over by Trump. It also includes state and local election officials, some Republicans, some not, who sort of looked at what Trump and the Republican Party were attempting to do and balked and pushed back. I think that it is easy now to make jokes about how absurd Trump's effort is. And I don't think it ever really would have worked, however you define work. But the reason that it wouldn't have worked was because an enormous amount of people, many of whose names we don't know, refused to go along with something in much the same way, I think, as we saw during the impeachment investigation, as Susan points out, and that should not be forgotten.
Alan, your heroes and villains.
So I'm going to start with villains first. And for me, it's a tie between Lindsey Graham on the one hand and almost the entire House GOP caucus on the other hand. I can't decide which is more embarrassing, the kind of years-long debasement of Lindsey Graham from John McCain's sidekick to, I don't know, I'm not even sure I can, this is a family show, so I'm not even sure I can express exactly what I think of Lindsey Graham over the last several years and his move towards towards Trump. But then on the other hand, you have a lot of House Republicans who signed on to just the craziest litigation before the Supreme Court to overturn a lawful election. And to me, the fact that they seem to have been able to do this without any consequence is just unbelievably damaging for the future of American democracy. So I'm going to say some combination of those two entities are my national security villains of the year. And for a hero, I'm going to pick maybe a more unconventional choice. So, and this is maybe a little less serious than the other heroes that were just talked about. But I'm sure like all of us, I found the Trump presidency incredibly stressful and blood pressure inducing. And that's just bad for the soul. And one thing that I learned is that one of the best ways to deal with Trump is through satire, because it's just such a great way of both putting him in his place and also doing it in a way that's quite entertaining. And for me, the great satirist of the Trump era, especially in this last year, is a comedian named Sarah Cooper. She kind of rocketed to fame through this TikTok video she did where she basically lip synced Trump's now infamous press conference where he talked about injecting bleach and ultraviolet light as a way of fighting coronavirus. And that blew up and went totally viral. And then she spent this last year lip syncing many of Trump's other insane statements. And what's just amazing about it is, in addition to being a great comedian and a great actor and really capturing Trump's mannerisms, she's also a Black woman who was born in Jamaica. And so just seeing this person in particular being able to completely skewer Trump in his own words, in his own voice, has been unbelievably satisfying. And now that Trump has lost, she will sadly have to retire her impressions of him. So I wanted to give her a shout out. She has been a surprisingly important for me way of psychologically coping with the madness that is the Trump administration.
I will second the endorsement of Sarah Cooper. I think she's magic. All right. Last item. In just a couple of days at midnight, we are all going to toast in the new year. What will you be toasting to, Alan?
I will be toasting to getting to be able to teach in person again. I have not gotten to see any of my students for what's coming up on a year now, ever since March, when the University of Minnesota, like universities all across the country, went remote. And, you know, I will say I've been surprised at how okay Zoom is for the basic tasks of teaching a class. And I'm really grateful that we had Zoom because it meant that we didn't lose a year of instruction, which was great. But for as good as Zoom is for the basics of getting my thoughts across to my students, it's terrible for building the kind of relationships that make law school so much fun and that make law school in particular so much fun to be as a professor. So, you know, this semester we're still going to be remote, but the vaccines are coming and soon enough we'll all be in person and it's just going to be a wonderful thing. And so that's what I will be toasting to on New Year's Eve.
Quinta, what will you be toasting to New Year's Eve?
Vaccines and the healthcare workers who are getting them and delivering them.
Susan Hennessy, what will you be drinking a glass of Prosecco to?
In keeping with a theme, just good health. I am certainly happy to put 2020 behind us. That said, this pandemic is not over. There are lots and lots of people that are going to die between now and when we have a sufficient number of Americans vaccinated. And so I will just be toasting in gratitude that my family and people I care about have mostly made it through this year unscathed. And hoping that we can preserve that last bit of fortitude for the next couple of months and hoping that our listeners and readers do the same. And so that we can all be here to toast 2022 and whatever that brings.
Scott Anderson, your toast for New Year's Eve.
Well, at the risk of being a little personal about it, you know, my wife and I are getting ready to welcome our first child into the world any day now. And we've had, you know, we got engaged in 2016, just before the election, and have both really kind of weathered together the last few years, seeing a lot of things that we really cared about as former public servants, as people who really have worked hard for American diplomacy and a lot of our values throughout our professional careers have found it really difficult and taken a lot of strength from each other. And I will say I'm really excited to be able to bring my son into a country and into a world that I think is finally back on the upswing. So that's what I'll be toasting to on New Year's.
Congratulations. I had a professor years ago at Oberlin College who every year he would wish for New Year's greetings to students. He would wish them precision in writing and proper grammar. And so I think I can improve upon this only by saying I will be toasting to sore arms, precision in writing, and proper grammar. May you all have an excellent New Year's, and we will see you on the Lawfare podcast very soon. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, our audio engineer. So many episodes this year has been Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. 2020 would have been very different without him. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only, the Wuhan-based Sophia Yan. Blame the virus on her. No, don't. She just reported on it. You need to do your part in the new year to promote the Lawfare podcast. So tweet it, share it on Facebook, all the social media stuff. Leave us the rating and review wherever you found us. And for God's sake, make a TikTok video about us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.